The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are M. Scott James, Dennis Norton, Dillis Powell, and Frank Muir. And here's round one, to test their respective vocabularies. For two marks, I want to know the meaning of these words. And we begin with Anne Scott James. Anne, what is a martello? M-A-R-T-E-L-L-O. Martello.
Well, it sounds like a kind of cocktail, alternatively. I think, in fact, it's a kind of tower.
What kind of tower?
A kind of defensive tower, which there are five or six or a dozen or so on the southeast, on Kent, southeast coast.
When did they happen?
They were put up in fear of a Napoleonic invasion.
Absolutely right. Martello, a small circular fort, as Anne quite rightly said, usually on the south and southeast side of the coast, to stop a hostile landing by Napoleon and his chaps. But it is a corruption of a cape in Corsica, Cape Martello, where there was a tower of this kind, which was captured by the English fleet in the Napoleonic Wars in 1794. Two more. Frank Muir, what is the meaning of trope? T-R-O-P-E.
It's a musical term. It means a twiddly bit.
Yes, that's one of the meanings. There is a literary meaning, which you may also know, Frank. I mean, I'll give you a mark.
It's a kind of figure of speech, metaphor.
Quite right. Two marks. It's
twiddly bit.
It's a twiddly bit, figurative use of a word, metaphorically or ironically, and in the Western Church, it was a phrase or a verse introduced as an embellishment into part of the text of the Mass, and it comes from a Greek word meaning a turn. Dennis Powell, what's the meaning of stithy? S-T-I-T-H-Y, stithy.
Well, it's something which stithers up or stitches up.
That doesn't help me much so far.
No?
No.
Can we change any of the consonants?
Yes, you could change one of the consonants with great profit.
The second one.
Yes.
Change the second one, the smithy.
Yes, that would help quite a lot.
T to M.
Yes, and what would that mean?
Would mean a smithy.
All right. Give you a mark. It originally meant smithy, an anvil, and hence a smithy or a forge, and it comes from a German word meaning just a stand. Shakespeare in Hamlet says, "My imaginations are as foul as Vulcan's stithy," which means the way he forged either nasty thoughts or nasty things on said which. Dennis Norton, what does copula mean?
Copula. Let me put it in verse. I wouldn't dare define a copula, but in the right time and place, it's extremely popular. it looks Latin.
Yes?
As far as I'm going to go.
Is it a link of any sort?
That's right.
Oh.
That's what I wanted. Okay. It's that which connects the subject and the predicate. And if I say, you are drunk, then the R is the copula between you and drunk. It's also in anatomy, a connection between bone and cartilage ligament. In music, it's a short transitional or connecting passage. Before we begin the next round, I shall read out a quotation for each team to write down, and the two women members will do well to study those quotations, because at the end, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. And Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton, your quotation is, "Honesty is the best policy." And Dillis Powell and Frank, yours is a rather longer one. "Full-blown poppies, overcharged with rain, decline the head and drooping kiss the plain."
And drooping kiss the... Do carry on, I'll join you in a minute.
That time.
Go.
All right. And in the last round, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their ideas of how these came to be said or written. Well, now we have a round of in words. I want to know what the phrase means, and two marks again. Anne Scott-James, in flagrante delicto.
Means you're absolutely caught in the act.
Yes. In the act of committing an offence, caught red-handed, while the offence is flagrant, is what it means in Latin, two marks. Frank Muir, in partibus. P-A-R-T-I-B-U-S. In partibus.
It's a North Country expression, really. It means, it means I'll be going in the coach with the other lad. I must confess, I didn't take Latin. I had a headache. That
your wife would know this straight away.
Oh, it's a part of the Catholic Mass.
Yeah? No, it's not quite, but it's a Catholic expression, yes.
I must say I've heard it.
Yes.
In partibus.
Oh. Well, I'm going to give you half a mark.
With the others.
Give you half a mark. It's short for in partibus infidelium. It means in the regions of infidels. And it's usually applied to a Roman Catholic bishop in a country whose title comes from some old diocese which has fallen away from the Christian faith and gone heathen. That's in partibus. Dennis Powell, in puris naturalibus.
Simple nature.
Yes, I want to know what you look like when you're like this. In puris.
Oh, naked.
Yes. It means starco. You can swim or walk or do anything else appropriate without any clothes on at all. This is in puris naturalibus. Dennis Norton, in petto. P-T-T-O. In petto.
Petto. Petto wouldn't be just about 10 minutes before in flagrante delicto. Before you take your cardigan off. I don't know, there's no petum, is it? The Latin doesn't suggest
it. No, it's Italian.
Does it mean in short?
No,
it doesn't.
Petto, would it be little? Yes,
it's little. No, I know, it ought to, but it doesn't.
Well, I don't know.
So this is Italian, isn't it?
Italian, yes.
It means in the coop, at home, in the field, in the... Come on, think of another word.
Yeah. No, make
pesto. Something
to do with a crime.
No, it's a temporal thing, not place, time rather than place.
Don't know.
Don't think you're going to get it.
No. Not a word.
It means something kept back or held in reserve, undisclosed. Cardinals in petto were those who were just about to be elected cardinals, but the public didn't know yet who they were.
Good
and it
help.
Comes from the Latin in pectore, which means in the breast or something still secret. Well, now we have a round about origins and derivations of words or phrases. I want to know first what the present meaning is, and then how the word or phrase originated. Two marks again. Anne Scott-James, etiquette.
It means a system or standards of polite behaviour.
Yes.
And is it anything to do with riding?
No.
It's a ticket, isn't it?
No.
It's a ticket.
Yeah.
So would it mean your entry form into a smart hat, into a house with owned by an earl and a countess?
You're getting very close indeed, yes. Put it up a bit, put the ante up.
Yes, it would be your ticket into the royal household, I think. No?
I think I'll give you two. It isn't absolutely dead right, but it's near enough. It now means the conventional rules of behaviour in polite society, or the unwritten code governing members of some professions, or the ceremonial of a court. But it used to be a ticket or a card on which the regulations and directions to be observed by those who attended court were written out. Now, Frank Muir, Grub Street.
Grub Street was a street in Moorfields, which, when Shakespeare was an actor, was inhabited by people who made arrows and bows. It then descended rather rapidly, becoming a street of gaming and dice. And then, in the early 17th century, it descended even further to becoming a place where writers of brief histories and...
Well done.
Dictionaries and temporary verse.
Well done.
Decided. It was, in fact, the place where hack writers live. But hack writers didn't exist till the 17th century, till the civil wars, and only really prospered at the in the time of Charles II. In the 19th century, the name was changed to Milton Street.
and it now was knocked down when the barbican was built.
If you don't know, stay.
Totally impossible for me to improve on that, and 2 marks straight away.
Now, Dr. Spar, the phrase, you are chaffing me.
Chaffing?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it means you're sort of making fun of me, teasing me.
How does it come to mean there?
Chaffing. Ah, to do with chaff?
Yes, it's something very simple and literal.
Oh. Chaff is the kind of what's left when you winnow the wheat.
Yes.
So you're sort of throwing me away lightly.
No, it isn't. No, you haven't got the exact connotation. It means you're making fun of me in a light-hearted sort of way. But it probably comes from an old custom which used to exist in the Midlands, in Leicestershire and Nottinghamshire. If a husband was supposed to be ill-treating his wife, neighbours would then empty a sack of chaff at his door to signify that thrashing was done within the house. So that it's that's the most plausible explanation I can give you. Dennis Norden, what is a one-eyed steak?
Well, where I was born in Mare Street, Hackney, that's what we used to call a kipper.
Absolutely dead right, 2 marks straight away. Yeah.
Two eyes. I know, but you—that's what they used to be called. Like in those days, I never used to worry about origins and derivations. Actually,
the kipper's like an opened-out dispatch rider's jerkin.
It's actually come to be used later as part of the last chapter of detective stories, where the detective would say, "All the others I suspected, but you." You're the one I'd stake my life.
Wish I could give you a bonus, but I won't. All right, now we come to the last round, and I go back to the 2 quotations I gave the teams earlier in the program. 2 marks and Scott James, can you give me the origin of your quotation? Honesty is the best policy.
Well, I just think it's a proverb.
It became one, certainly. But it did have an...
It had an older...
It had a chap who said it first, as far as we know.
And we know who, do we?
Yes.
A sort of 17th century chap.
A little earlier.
16th century chap. Well, it wouldn't be... is that the right century?
Yes, we're doing awfully well.
It's a writer.
I'm going to give
You're not going to say it's Shakespeare. I couldn't bear it after all
I'm going to give you half a mark for getting the right century and all that. Now, it was a chap called Sands, S-A-N-D-Y-S... And in 1904, the paper The Spectator quoted Archbishop Whately as saying, honesty is the best policy, but he is not an honest man who is honest for this reason. So it has a sort of ironical connotation. Half a mark. Now, to dispel the origin of your quotation, full-blown poppies, overcharged with rain, decline the head and, drooping, kiss the plain.
If somebody wrote in verse...
Yes.
Rather unsuccessfully, I should say.
Well, he made quite a good living at it.
Did he?
Oh, yes.
He.
particularly for this work.
Can't have been Pope.
It is Pope.
Iliad. Pope made his money out of a subscription copy of the Iliad.
Ashamed of himself.
It is Alexander Pope's translation of Homer's Iliad in his own particular kind of heroic couplets. Well, now I'm going to ask Dennis and Frank to give me their improbable explanations of how these quotations came into being. And for this round only, the marks will go to whichever unlikely story gets the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. And so back to Dennis Norden and his line, honesty is the best policy.
Let me tell you how I first came to meet Nifty McGraw. I was working on an idea for a B picture, which I think had rather a novel twist. It was about a gangster who was owned by a syndicate of boxers. Well, in order to do some research on how criminals behave and think, I asked Wandsworth Prison if I could interview one of their customers, and they said, well, you come along next visiting day and take your choice. Well, when I got there, the first bloke I noticed was a rather doleful-looking little man with a very distraught wife the other side of the grill. And she was saying, I'll be there when you come out, Nifty. We'll take up the threads of our life again. I'll wait for you. I swear I'll wait for you, Nifty. And he said, good blimey, Alice, they only give me 7 days. Now, you may think that 7 days was rather a light sentence for a case of armed robbery, but what actually happened in the armed robbery was very typical of the man. Nifty was holding this chap up, and the chap pleaded with him, please, don't take my wallet. I've got all my money in it, all the rent money. And to which Nifty answered, look, mate, I'm just about fed up with hearing all these hard luck stories. You think you're the only one who got troubles? Look at me. I can't even afford to buy bullets for this gun. So you see what I mean about Nifty. They say that every criminal makes mistakes, but Nifty got this down to a science. What other criminal would half inch a large colour TV set right under the eyes of the store detective, and as soon as he got it home, send away for the 1 year guarantee? He got the year all right. You see, Nifty's trouble is this fatal carelessness or impatience. I know what it is. He worked out an absolutely brilliant raid on the Piccadilly branch of Barclays Bank, and then right there, right inside the bank, while he was actually writing out the note to shove under the cashier's grill, he turns to the commissionaire and he says, is there a hyphen in the word hold up? He spent that Christmas in Dartmoor. I tackled him about this flaw in his character, because when we got to know each other, he invited me home, and he showed me his little souvenirs. You see that on the wall? He said, that's the first pound I ever made. I said, why have you got it framed? He said, quarter of an inch too short. Now, you can't argue with a man like that, can you? I mean, what kind of a mastermind will make an obscene telephone call, then try and reverse the charge? Is it no wonder this Nifty McGraw has been living off national assistance for the last 2 decades? And when I said to him, what can society do about a man like you? He said, stop me before I strike again. I said to him, Nifty, the way you strike, there is no criminal for whom the old saying is more true. Honesty is the least poverty.
Well, I guess a very sad story. We'll try Frank Muir next, and if you remember, his quotation was, full-blown poppies overcharged with rain, decline the head, and drooping, kiss the plane.
You'll never do it.
For the last 10 weeks, I have not been either looking or being myself. My friends have noticed this. Some of them have commented on the improvement. But in fact, I've been through a rather deep emotional experience. An experience of mixed emotions, really. Mixed emotions has been defined as watching your mother-in-law drive over a cliff in your new car. But perhaps in a more modern phraseology, it is the good news, bad news thing. My good news was that 10 weeks ago, my Afghan hound had 6 puppies. And now for the bad news, 10 weeks ago, my Afghan hound had 6 puppies. the bad and the good with this sort of thing go together, and it has been a traumatic experience. One thing about Afghan puppies is they grow visibly. Every breath they take is like sort of putting one foot on the foot pump of a beach mattress. You can see them growing before your eyes. It's one of the sad facts of this so-called welfare state that you can't have puppies on the national health. Our vet came the third day. He didn't get out of the car because it was spitting with rain. He just shouted, "Kittens okay? Right." 2 guineas. He did ring up and say that if there's any emergency, they've got an ambulance they can send, 30 guineas. No wonder they go, "Puppy, puppy." When they were 8 weeks old, a couple of weeks ago, we decided to civilize our 6 puppies and bring them into the dining room in the evenings. This worked terribly well, and we saw how intelligent they could be. They also are very obedient. You've only got to just look at them, the boy particularly, and say, "Don't do that." And they just look at you. And the first time I looked at him, the oldest boy, I said, "Now that's wrong. That's wrong to sink your teeth into Daddy's ankle and draw blood. It is not good." And he just looked at me. And suddenly I saw a little sovereign on the floor below him. And the golden sovereign grew to saucer size. And it grew to plate size. He didn't move a muscle, he just stood there. The girls are different. The first time I met him after the girl, she curtsied. The only difference is the curtsy you usually get up after bobbing. And there was the golden sovereign. It is now 10 weeks old, and all 6 are still unsold. And then the local paper, the Evening Mail, said, "We understand you've got some Afghan puppies. Can we send our photographer along and photograph you with them?" I thought, yes, yes, people will see. Things lovely standing there, these beautiful, huge, lovely, wild things. Super. So the photographer came along, and I got them in a pen made of chicken wire around 3 apple trees on the grass. There's the photographer. I said, "Right, where do you want me?" He said, "With the dogs." I said, "Indeed, sir, of course," so delighted. And I leapt the I almost leapt the wire. I missed by about an inch, crashed to the ground, and came to with these wild, mad dogs licking my face. And that is the photograph he took. And that is the photograph I got this morning, and they said, "Would I put a caption to it?" Well, I thought the only thing to do is to put a caption, some line, couplet from Homer. Something like the one Jack said, "Full-blown poppies, overcharged with rain, decline the head and drooping kiss the plain." Well, it doesn't quite fit, but if we altered it a bit, because really, I've come to the conclusion that in spite of their surplus energy and their wickedness, they're really going to go up into rather nice dogs, because when I was lying there insensible, they did try to revive me with their little licks. So I thought I'd alter Homer a little and put us a caption. How do you think this will fit? "Full-grown puppies, overcharged and bad, decline the head and drooping kiss their dad."
Well, 20 quid or nearest offer, gratefully received. And by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Frank Muir wins the contest of the stories, and he and Dillis Powell also win this entire contest. And that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland, who also compiled the questions. The program was devised by Tony Schryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.
You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.